Our next speaker is very familiar to you, I'm sure. Carrie Janelle is a music historian, discographer, and author of 7 books on American jazz and Western swing. And in addition to writing about music, he's also a performer. He plays flute and piccolo while leading his own group, the Sedalia Ragtime Orchestra, which recently played the Scott Joplin Festival in Sedalia. He also has taken to delivering lectures and entertaining on America's waterways, on the cruises for American cruise lines. So if you want to take a cruise, here's the guy that'll entertain you. Last week he returned from a cruise on the Mississippi River, as a matter of fact, and he came here, which we appreciate. This is his 11th ARSC presentation. He's a 5-time winner of the ARSC Award for Excellence. He has 2 more books this year, just can't hold a good guy down. His first book being Walk Tall, The Life and Music of Cannonball Adderley, published in March by Hal Leonard, which you see there. And this fall, the same publisher will be publishing Carrie's biography of singer Billy Eckstein, who is the subject of this morning's talk, Carrie Janelle.
Good morning. In 1950, Billy Eckstein was the most famous singer in the world. Screaming teenagers swooned to his sold-out performances in overcrowded concert halls. He was married to a beautiful socialite, had a spacious home in a fashionable Los Angeles suburb, and was looking forward to a career in motion pictures and television. But a controversial photograph published in a Life magazine profile halted the momentum of his career right at its peak. There are those who believe that although Eckstein was successful, he never realized his potential and played out the rest of his career as a Las Vegas lounge singer. So was Billy Eckstein's career tragic? It all depends on your point of view. William Clarence Eckstein Jr. was born in Pittsburgh on July 8, 1914. His great-grandfather, who was white, emigrated from Germany in the mid-19th century. In 1880, Billy's grandfather married the daughter of a former slave, and the couple had 2 children, one of whom, William Clarence Eckstein Sr., became Billy's father. The Ecksteins led a comfortable life in Pittsburgh. Billy's father worked as a bellman and chauffeur for a prominent newspaper publisher. At the time Billy was born, the family, consisting of his parents and 2 older sisters, lived in the fashionable Highland Park section on the north side of Pittsburgh. As a boy, young Billy delivered newspapers and was a good student in school. He began singing at age 4, learning spirituals sung to him by his grandmother. He grew up tall and handsome and continued his singing at church bazaars and other functions. His smooth, rich, velvety baritone and wide vibrato made him popular with the girls in his high school. In 1930, Eckstein moved to Washington to complete high school after his older sister moved there to become a teacher. His idol at the time was Cab Calloway, the charismatic leader of the house band at Harlem's Cotton Club. Eckstein grew a pencil-thin mustache like Calloway and won a talent contest at Washington's Howard Theater, emulating Cab by singing Stardust in his style. But young Billy Eckstein aspired to be more than just a shuck and jive jazz singer. He preferred romantic ballads, and in the 1930s, patterned his quickly developing style after the top crooners of the day, including Bing Crosby, Harlan Lattimore, and Fa Terrell. By 1934, big things were being predicted for the 18-year-old high school senior. He sang and led the Tommy Miles Orchestra, and after graduating, started his own band at Pittsburgh Savoy Ballroom, calling himself Baron Billy. This began a 3-year routine of playing small nightclubs in Pittsburgh, Buffalo, and Detroit, before a friend of his, saxophonist arranger Bud Johnson, invited him to come to Chicago. It was the summer of 1938, and Eckstein got a job singing at Club DeLisa, a mob-run nightclub on the south side of the city. In September 1939, he joined the Earl Hines Orchestra, one of the hottest big bands in the nation. It wasn't long before he became its most popular drawing card. At the time he joined Hines, Eckstein could barely read music, but thanks to Bud Johnson, he not only learned to read, but also taught himself to play trumpet and later valve trombone. He spent the next 4 years learning the band business from Hines, and in February 1940, made his first record.
Something in your eyes tells me you're from paradise. You're an angel in disguise. My heart beats for you. Every dream should dream of you. Darling, come to me, please do. My heart beats for you.
My Heart Beats for You was just an ordinary ballad, but at the band's next Victor session, Eckstein had his first hit. He wrote the song himself, getting the idea while listening to a band member talking to his girlfriend on the phone during a break. In 20 minutes, it was finished, and the band recorded it as the last song of the session.
Jelly, 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 jelly stays on my mind. Jelly, 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 jelly stays on my mind. Jelly roll.
Although Jelly Jelly became a huge hit, Billy Eckstein stated on many occasions that he hated singing blues tunes. "They're commercial," he told Metronome in 1947, "but you can't do anything with them." But Eckstein's aversion to blues extended further than that. To him and to the other forward-thinking musicians in the Hines Band, the blues represented white promoters' way of keeping African-American performers in their place, reflecting the white world's view of the primitive nature of blacks. Eckstein later said, "The white man thinks that blues is all a black man should sing." What he wanted to sing were romantic ballads from the early 30s, but these were what white balladeers sang, and Southern audiences demanded songs like Jelly Jelly and its successor, Stormy Monday Blues. In August 1943, Eckstein left Hines to start a band with trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie and saxophonist Charlie Parker, who had been developing their own complex musical ideas that would result in bebop. Joining them was a young singer Eckstein had discovered at the Apollo Theater named Sarah Vaughan. The group became the first bebop orchestra. Unfortunately, the AFM musician strike prevented the band from being recorded commercially until the next year. But even without records, the new Eckstein Orchestra became the hottest band in America. During its 3 years of existence, the band included many of bebop's pioneers, with Fats Navarro, Gene Ammons, Art Blakey, Miles Davis, and Dexter Gordon joining its ranks. Hard drugs became a factor in the band's relatively short life, and even Eckstein himself briefly suffered from heroin addiction. When he realized he was hooked, Eckstein went back to his parents' home in Pittsburgh, shut himself in his room, and went through withdrawal on his own. He never used hard drugs again, although cocaine did become an issue later in life. With the AFM strike still going strong, Eckstein signed a contract with the Deluxe record label out of Linden, New Jersey, and in April 1944, he held a session using studio musicians. With the rationing of shellac during the war, Deluxe's pressings were made from a gumbo of cardboard, sawdust, hide glue, asphalt, and glass, resulting in an inferior, noisy sound. After the session, Eckstein hired a permanent band, employing Dizzy Gillespie as music director and Charlie Parker on alto sax. Parker stayed with the band only a few months, and by the time of their next session in October, he had already left. The power of the orchestra can be heard in Blowin' the Blues Away, which features a saxophone battle between Gene Ammons and Dexter Gordon.
I got the blues 'cause my baby put me down. I got the blues 'cause my baby put me down. I'm gonna grab a train and leave this lonesome town. So blow, Mr. Gene, blow, Mr. Dexter, too. Blow, Mr. Gene, blow, Mr. Dexter, too. Maybe you can help me and blow away the blues.
Incidentally, it was Billy Shaw, his manager at the time, who decided that Eckstein should respell his name. It was originally the family name E-C-K-S-T-E-I-N, but there were too many Southern promoters that thought he was white and Jewish, and they wanted to attract African Americans, so they spelled it S-T-I-N-E, and Eckstein officially gave the reason that he wanted people to pronounce his name right, but that wasn't the entire story. Frustrated with Deluxe, Eckstein signed with Herb Abramson's National label in 1945 and had his first big crooning hits, including A Cottage for Sale and Prisoner of Love. In 1946, the Eckstein band made a half-hour short film for the Associated Producers of Negro Motion Pictures. Titled Rhythm in a Riff, the movie was produced to take advantage of Eckstein's growing popularity in the South. The threadbare script and poor acting were typical of movies of this kind, but the film is valuable in that it is the only known visual evidence we have of Eckstein's celebrated bebop orchestra. We're going to play a clip from the movie that features Eckstein singing and scatting the title song with Art Blakey on drums and a sax solo by Gene Ammons.
Oh, I don't even know your name.
Martin, Bill Martin.
This is Joe Corwin, owner of the club here.
How do you do, Mr. Corwin?
Hello, Bill. Look, young man, I'm stuck for a band, and I need a good one. My new floor show goes in tonight.
Well, my boys are pretty good. Why don't you give us a chance to show?
Well, I'm willing to listen. Tell me, about how fast can you get them down here for an audition?
How fast? Well, when my boys pass the word around, they'll be down here just like that. Gosh, honey, I never know how to thank you for this.
Oh, that's easy, Billy. You just play real good so that Joe will buy the band. Then maybe later you and me can talk about it, okay?
Sure, and when I sing, I'll be singing right to you.
First, give me a nice rhythm tune so I can see how you can work with my chorus. Then go into a love song, something familiar. Can you do that?
You just sit there and listen. We'll do the rest.
Just like it left body, little, the finger make it swing. I love the muted trumpet tone, blended with the mellow saxophone. What a lot of kicks it brings. When that rhythm's in ya, the blues don't have a chance. Find that groove in ya, make you never think about romance. Jump, jump your rhythm with the riff. Any kind of music, it's a lift. Body, little, anything you make it swing. When that rhythm's in ya, the blues don't have a chance. Find that groove with ya, making us think about romance. Thank you.
Riffin' is the thing for me.
And just a footnote about this. The dozen or so songs that were used in this short were later excerpted and used for the Soundies Corporation. He called his character Bill Martin, but in a later scene you can see him conducting his band, and there's clearly B.E.'s on every single bandstand that he had there, so quality control lacking. Billy Eckstine's success with ballads on national records resulted in his taking steps to become identified with love songs as opposed to blues and bebop. He was keenly aware that there was money to be made as a crossover artist. His good looks were already attracting the attention of talent scouts in Hollywood, and the band business was not as good as it once was. During the next few years, he made screen tests for MGM and 20th Century Fox. Plans were made to pair him up on screen with Lena Horne, but no project ever got beyond the planning stage, in part because Eckstine refused to appear in any motion picture without his band. In 1947, Eckstine broke up his band and became one of the first performers to sign with the new MGM record label, giving all of his bebop charts to Dizzy Gillespie. With ties to the motion picture studio, Eckstine felt that MGM would live up to their promise to use him in feature films. Although his MGM records sold millions of copies, they couldn't penetrate the segregated playlist of white American radio stations. MGM used a succession of top-flight orchestrators and arrangers to back Eckstine, including Hugo Winterhalter, Pete Rugolo, and a young Nelson Riddle before he went with Frank Sinatra. Billed under such pandering pseudonyms as the Bronze Balladeer, the Sepia Sinatra, and the Vibrato, Eckstine became better known by the more dignified nickname of Mr. B. His fan club sported suggestive names like the Vibrato's Vibrators, and the girls who give in when Billy gives out. He designed and patented a high roll collar that formed a B over a Windsor knotted tie, which became known as a Mr. B collar. Eckstine's unique design allowed the collar to expand and contract, which the singer found advantageous when playing valve trombone solos. From 1947 until 1955, Eckstine recorded mostly syrupy ballads for MGM, which became hugely popular with his legion of young, mostly female fans. An appearance at New York's Paramount Theater, which previously saw legions of Bobby Soxers shriek in ecstasy at the sight of Frank Sinatra, repeated the practice with Eckstine. When asked if he missed his beloved big band, he would simply reply, "I have seven kids to feed." In April 1950, a profile of Eckstine in Life magazine showcased his superstar lifestyle. One photograph in particular, this one, caused much controversy. A shot of the singer emerging from a Manhattan nightery, being mobbed by white female fans. What should have been a landmark in the fight for racial equality turned into a public relations disaster, curtailing Eckstine's plans to star in motion pictures. Although the image appears innocent today, in 1950, Southern whites saw it as a threat to their teenage daughters and sent racist hate mail to the magazine. Many believe that Eckstine's ambitions to become a movie star vanished because of this one photograph. He made only one appearance in films in the 1950s, crooning the song "Hold Me Close to You" in a dispensable Esther Williams vehicle called Skirts Ahoy. He never achieved his goal of becoming a movie or television star. Eckstine emerged from his phalanx of romantic ballads only sporadically to record acclaimed jazz sides with Sarah Vaughan, George Shearing, and Woody Herman. By the way, today is Woody Herman's 100th birthday. But Eckstine mostly stuck with lugubrious, heavily orchestrated ballads. His biggest hit from this period, and one of the songs most identified with him, was "I Apologize."
If I told a lie, if I made you cry, when I said goodbye, I'm sorry. From the bottom of my heart, dear, if I cause you pain. I know I'm to blame. Must have been insane. Believe me, from the bottom of my heart, dear, I apologize.
Billy Eckstine was the biggest star of the early 1950s, which prompted a parody by Spike Jonze, who recorded a devastating satire on Eckstine's lazy vocalizing on this recording of Deep Purple, featuring the genius of Paul Frees.
When the deep purple falls over sleepy garden walls and the stars begin to flicker in the sky, in the midst of a memory, you wander back to me, breathing my name.
Occasionally, Eckstine got to exercise his jazz chops for MGM, as in this 1953 recording with other poll winners chosen by readers of Metronome magazine. But MGM sales were falling, so in 1955, Eckstine exercised his option and left MGM to sign with RCA Victor, which was busy promoting its newest star, Elvis Presley. Targeting Presley's audience, RCA assigned Eckstine to its music director, Hugo Winterhalter, who had worked with him at MGM. The results were disastrous, as Winterhalter produced heavy-handed orchestrations of puerile songs by Tin Pan Alley hacks, designed to pander to young rock and roll audiences.
Early in the morning, she's in that rockin' mood. She rocks all night in the candy store while the baby cries for food. When I come home for dinner, the dinner's never there. She's listening to some jockey who is rocking on the air. Condemned, 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 condemned for life to live with the rock and roll wife.
So after a year with RCA, during which time he recorded four more singles of this nature, Eckstine signed with Mercury Records. He reconstituted his nightclub act to include more jazz numbers and soon became a staple at Las Vegas showrooms. In 1957, his comeback began with an album tribute to Irving Berlin featuring Eckstine and old friend Sarah Vaughan.
Tossing is my sleep.
He's someone who's older.
And what's more, I've lost my appetite.
There's nothing you can take
to relieve
that present ache.
Our twinkling,
you're not
in
sick,
my
you're
eye.
Just
I wonder
in love.
In 1957, Eckstein embarked on a three-month tour with the Birdland All-Stars, joining Sarah Vaughan, Count Basie, Jerry Southern, and others. A duet with Vaughan, Passing Strangers, became a moderate hit, inspiring Birdland's manager, Morris Levy, to sign Eckstein to a contract to record for Roulette. The first album teamed him with Count Basie and his orchestra. Titled Basie Eckstein Incorporated, it included three new compositions by Eckstein. One of these, Blues the Mother of Sin, is almost Gershwin-esque in its atmosphere and beauty, as Eckstein reached down into the depths of his life experiences, channeling them into one of the most powerful performances of his career. For a man who had at one time said he couldn't do anything with the blues, Eckstein proved otherwise.
When I'm feeling happy, trouble and song, making me lonely, sad as can be. Won't you ever get wise? Try some happier guys.
The early 60s was a golden age for Las Vegas's Rat Pack, and Eckstein became huge in Sin City and around the world. He recorded an album of songs in French in Paris in 1960, and during a world tour, stopped off in Rio de Janeiro later that year to record two songs, one by a new Brazilian composer named Antonio Carlos Jobim. A Felicidade was held back for release in the U.S. until 1964, when it was inserted, without crediting the Brazilian musicians, into an album of songs for motion pictures. Recently, I acquired a 78 issued on the Brazilian Philips label that proves that the song was recorded by Roulette and licensed to Philips in 1960. This makes it the earliest known recording of bossa nova by an American artist with Brazilian musicians, preceding Stan Getz's Jazz Samba album by 2 years.
Tristeza não tem fim, felicidade sim.
Fala comigo!
Tristeza não tem fim, felicidade sim. Tristeza não tem fim, felicidade sim.
felicidade é como a pluma que o vento vai levando pelo ar. Voa tão leve, mas tem a vida breve, precisa que haja vento sem parar.
In the 1960s, Eckstein had a comfortable career as a Las Vegas nightclub entertainer. He befriended Martin Luther King Jr. and participated in the growing civil rights movement, supporting and campaigning for Democratic candidates. But he was still convinced that he could regain the youthful audiences he had during his MGM years. After a second stint with Mercury in the early 60s, he was signed to Motown. Label head Berry Gordy Jr. signed Eckstein along with Tony Martin and Connie Haynes to try and expand the label's base. But Motown's formula didn't work for Eckstein. And in 1968, after three unsuccessful albums, they gave up on each other. Eckstein's next stop was with Stax Records, another powerhouse label that catered to young African-American audiences. He even appeared at Wattstax, the African-American music festival equivalent of Woodstock, alongside the Staple Singers and Isaac Hayes. But his Stax covers of current rock hits were an ill fit and went nowhere.
Well, there's a rose in the fisted glove, and the eagle flies with the dove. And if you can't be with the one you love, honey, love the one you with. 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 Don't be angry.
In 1974, Eckstein turned 60. And he finally gave up trying to have hit records again. During the 70s, he appeared in a cameo role in the television sitcom Sanford and Son, and two films, Richard Pryor's JoJo Dancer, Your Life is Calling, and the Sidney Poitier Bill Cosby comedy, Let's Do It Again. Those were his only film appearances since Skirts Ahoy in 1951. By now, his chief passion was sports. A scratch golfer since the 50s, Eckstein played 36 holes of golf every day of his life, often accompanied by Charlie Sifford, a pioneering African-American golfer who broke the PGA's color barrier. He was also a huge fan of boxing, football, and baseball, befriending such luminaries as Joe Louis, Jackie Robinson, and Oakland Raiders owner Al Davis, who gave Eckstein a gold pass, admitting him to any NFL football game. In 1979, he started performing with his daughter Gina, beginning in San Francisco's Fairmont Hotel. Later that year, he recorded an album of American and Brazilian standards, remixed in Rio de Janeiro with a Brazilian string section. Eckstein was hoping that Norman Granz's Pablo label would release it, but in the end, it was issued only on Brazil's obscure Som Livre label and was never heard in the U.S.
Gone away, and I'm alone with a memory of her last love, vague and drawn and sad. I see it still, all her heartbreak in that last look.
In 1984, at age 70, Eckstein was still the ladies' man. At a luncheon with editors of Jet and Ebony magazines, a female autograph seeker told Eckstein that her mother was his biggest fan, and then asked, "Is Jelly Jelly a commercial?" To which Eckstein replied with a sly wink and a smile, "That all depends on what you're selling, honey." In 1986, federal agents raided Eckstein's bungalow at the Las Vegas Country Club, and confiscated personal items to be auctioned to pay off $250,000 in debts. Among the items taken by the IRS were personal memorabilia, including gold records, musical instruments, awards, posters, and other items. A public auction was averted when an unidentified friend, who the family believes was Bill Cosby, made an offer for the materials that exceeded what the IRS thought they could get for it otherwise, and returned it all to Eckstein. His last record date came 2 months later, when he recorded an album of jazz featuring saxophonist Benny Carter. But Eckstein's voice was shot. Music critic Will Friedwald, probably Eckstein's biggest champion, described it as a tremolo in search of a voice. The most poignant number of the session was September Song, a masterpiece of wistful nostalgia that Eckstein was perfectly suited for at this stage in his career.
Oh, the days dwindle down to a precious few. September, November, and these few precious days I'll spend with you. These precious days I'll spend.
In April 1992, Eckstein suffered a stroke while performing at a country club in Salina, Kansas. No longer able to perform, he returned to Pittsburgh and was admitted to a rehabilitation facility. There, he suffered a heart attack and was sent to Montefiore Hospital, where his family gathered around him, waiting for the inevitable end. In his final days, his children played music for him on a boombox they had put in his room, but Eckstein was rarely responsive. On March 8, 1993, daughters Gina and Charlotte were shocked when their father suddenly woke up. Gina recalled asking him, "Hey, Dad, we've listened to Bird, we've listened to Miles. What do you want to hear now?" Eckstein croaked one word, "Basie." Gina recalled that before he uttered that word, his last, he hadn't said anything in weeks. An hour later, he was gone. He was 78. Billy Eckstein's last word was his Rosebud moment, a name that summed up his entire life's desire, which was not to be a movie or television star after all, or to have hit records. Eckstein's passion was his swinging bebop band of the 1940s, which turned out to be his most lasting legacy. 2014 will mark Billy Eckstein's centennial. In addition to the publication of my biography of Eckstein this fall, a PBS documentary is being planned to help reassess one of the most important singers in 20th century music. Thank you.
I want to thank both speakers today. Unfortunately, we've run over time. So if you have questions, come on up. Hopefully they'll be able to stay for a few minutes. And this concludes the session. Thank you very much.